The following podcast is a part of the Spin Studio Network. Hello and welcome to another episode of Empowered. I am really excited to introduce our guest today and to have this conversation with Teela. Teela Reid is a proud Wiradjuri and Wailwan woman. She's a former teacher, a 5-times marathon runner, and an activist. Teela was Australia's female Indigenous youth delegate to the United Nations Forum in New York that inspired her journey to become a lawyer. This conversation made me sit with my privilege, which raised a lot of my own discomfort, but we need to open up space for these conversations to happen because for change to happen, we need to acknowledge and be accountable to what is happening across the continent. If this conversation causes discomfort within you, I encourage you to invite that. I know it's hard, but without the acknowledgement of the truth and without holding ourselves accountable, there is no chance for change. And we desperately need change. Please listen up to the strength and wisdom of Teela Reid. Welcome everybody to the Empowered Podcast. I would love to begin our gathering and recording today by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land, land and waters which have never been ceded. I am recording on the Yugambeh country and pay my respects to their elders past and present. I stand in solidarity with the Indigenous people today and every day. I am joined by the lovely Teela Reid. I just want to say thank you so much from the top, Teela, for your energy and your presence today. I understand that it's a really challenging, emotionally draining time for you, and I just am so grateful for your time today.
Yeah, Yama Ravi. My name's Teela Reid. I am a proud Wiradjuri and Wailwan woman born and raised in Gilgandra, Western New South Wales. I am currently coming to you guys in this podcast today, though, from my current location, which is the sovereign lands and waters of the Bidjigal and Gadigal people. So I get to call this place home now, and I feel very welcomed by the ancestors here on this country.
Lovely. I would love to begin our conversation today by talking or learning a little bit more about where you grew up and how you came to do the work that you do today.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Like, if I look at where I'm at now, a practicing lawyer in the inner city kind of CBD of Sydney, where I come from, I never thought that I would be living the life I'm living today. I was born and raised back home in Western New South Wales on my country in Gilgandra. Interestingly, that's a town that borders three different First Nations, of the Wiradjuri, Gomeroi and Wailwan people. So that has an interesting story in and of itself. But yeah, I was very lucky to grow up in my hometown, lived in a little house with my single mom and my little sister across the road from our grandparents. And we were very lucky, I think, in those days, just so full of love. I'm kind of the first generation to be born and raised off the missions. And I really think that it was the stories and the practices of my grandparents that really shaped the kind of advocacy that I feel like I've been drawn to out of a sense of community and cultural obligation today. I did all of my schooling back home in public school. Interestingly enough, I remember as well kind of marching out of preschool and telling my mom I quit preschool. And I negotiated with her that I would quit preschool, but I'm ready for big school. And so when I started primary school and high school in my hometown, I think, you know, it was really a point where I had committed myself to, you know, learning the stories of my people, but at the same time, dismantling those systems and processes. And I had a very strong understanding that as soon as I walked through the school gates, it was really profoundly obvious to me that this was a foreign world. because, you know, walking into the school and back home are two very different worlds. The stories passed down to me at home were very different to the stories of colonization and, you know, what you learn in school. Like, one example is, I remember consistently this idea of each year we would learn about the Australian Anzacs. And each year we would kind of be asked to remember an Anzac and colouring in this Anzac. And I remember that person always being someone of a European descent. And I was then learning stories about how my people were actually sent to the front line of wars and didn't come home from war with the same recognition. And so I had a very strong understanding of the fact that there was a real contest in truth-telling about the history of our nation. And so that really unsettled me. But coming through my schooling, I was a very competitive person, and that competitive streak really played out in the sporting fields. I remember being, you know, playing lots of different sports. And so the natural transition for me from high school was to go on and be a PE teacher. And I was a high school PE teacher for 3 years, but during that time I was selected as Australia's Indigenous female youth delegate to the United Nations in New York. And when I had that experience, I was introduced to a world of First Nations advocacy and different people from around the globe who were fighting for different rights for their people. And it really occurred to me that colonization was a global process and all different First Nations were at different points of that spectrum of colonization. So I came home from New York and really contemplated my teaching career and how I could fulfill my cultural obligations to my community. And I thought, well, you know, at that point in time, the issue on the agenda in the United Nations was the Northern Territory intervention. That was one of the main points of dispute, and for the Australian state anyway. And I recall, you know, learning about the fact that for our federal government to essentially unleash its own army on its people in the Northern Territory, it effectively had the power to suspend the Racial Discrimination Act to effectively implement a racist policy. And it really kind of, I started to think about, well, if that's what power and the law can do, I feel an obligation to go home and learn this system to ensure my people have the right knowledge about how we can disrupt, decolonize this process. And I see my role as a lawyer ultimately as a resource to my people.
That is such an incredible story, Tila, and I just have to admire you and your perseverance. I mean, I think it was very telling, you as a little preppy or a kindergarten, that you wanted to, I guess, advocate for yourself at such a young age. I can only imagine how confusing it was as a young child going through school and hearing two opposing views from school and your family life. And then for you to put your hand up out of school and say, you know what, I'm actually going to become a defence lawyer to be that resource for your people and meet those cultural obligations. I'm just in awe and have so much admiration for you. I would love to hear what it was like growing up for you, because I feel like there are a lot of perspectives from people that believe these difficult times and these acts of racism from authority is a thing of the past or a thing that happened a long, long time ago. And what I would love to hear, if you are able to share today, Tila, because I understand this is just a very hard thing for you to raise and to speak through, is what your upbringing was like, and perhaps, you know, your grandparents and your close family, like how close it was that it was so horrible.
I have to admit, I feel as though my family worked really hard to surround me with love and care. That, you know, because of the generations before me had not had that privilege. So, for example, there are so many stories in my family about my people being forced onto missionaries, to have to ask permission to come and go from the missions, to not be allowed to walk on the same side of the street as white people, to not be allowed to sit in the bar or go into stores run by white people, or even, for example, stories of not being allowed to drink the same milk at schools when they eventually started to go to common schools. And I think one of the most horrific things that really kind of, you know, stabs a kind of knife through my heart still is the stories of my great grandparents having to wear dog tags around their necks by virtue of being Aboriginal. So there are lots of stories that have really shaped my family's experiences of injustice in the world. And as someone who I feel, you know, we were very poor. Like I say I was raised in love, it was still very, very poor. I remember times where my mother couldn't even pay for the electricity bill and we'd have to have candles in the house because we couldn't afford the electricity. But to me, I wasn't poor. I was so rich with stories. I was so rich with yarns in my grandma's garden. I remember if we felt ill, my grandma would go out bush and she would get some medicine and come back and cook it up, and you know that. So my view of the world, on the one hand, I feel like I had a very loved experience as a child. It is not lost on me how poor and oppressed we were. I recall, for example, one time having chicken pox as a kid. I think I was in about year one, and I was so violently ill that I was kind of bedridden and sweaty for a week. And I recall my mother telling me, go hide in the cupboard. And I was like, why? And I was so sick, and she's like shoved me in a cupboard. And it wasn't until after the fact I knew that she knew the authorities were coming to the door to check why I wasn't at school. And so, you know, my schooling was through the Howard era. That fear that First Nations women in particular live with, of you know, losing their children. And today we have the highest rate still in New South Wales of child removals of from families. So we have a whole new stolen generations happening. It, you know, while I feel so protected by the love I had, it was absolutely not lost on me about the monitoring of our families, about the control that still plays out in terms of, and we see that as a society where there is a disproportionate rate of First Nations peoples coming before the court. You know, we see that as a society of the overrepresentation of First Nations peoples in prison. And what kind of is a profound, I think, example is in the last decade, the highest rate of incarceration in our country is First Nations women. And that cannot be because we are more criminal. It is that over-policing, that monitoring, and that racist impact of the laws that we're still experiencing. And so, yeah, that's my experience growing up. And I think there is kind of a strength that for me that comes from my stories and my lived experience, and now knowing that because of those stories, I have an opportunity to build the life I want. I'm making sure that I am absolutely doing what I can while I'm here to leave a lasting legacy on the changes, so that the next generation, your children, you know, my children, don't have to live with these injustices.
Absolutely. As we're recording this, it's the 27th of January, which obviously is around the week and the time of the what we call Invasion Day, what others may call Australia Day. And in one of your recent articles that you've written with Marie Claire, you've shared that when you grew up in Gilgandra in Western New South Wales, that within your community, it's was obviously not a day to celebrate, but a day to speak of your of the history and the trauma that your peoples had to endure. And then it wasn't until you were able to, you grew older and you stepped away from your own community, that you understood that there were people in this country, in this land, that celebrate a day that represents invasion, colonization, massacres and slavery. I mean, that must have been so confronting, confusing and just a horrible perspective to gain.
Yeah. Growing up in my community, you know, I was lucky to have elders and grandparents around me. And part of kind of, you know, my life schooling really outside of the Western system was that I was raised by my grandfather, who was a grassroots activist in land rights. So a lot of, you know, my knowledge about the world as well, we know during the 60s and 70s there was a huge movement to push for land rights in Australia, which we know now is marked by the Aboriginal Tent Embassy, which is the longest protest in the world. So as a child, you know, it was never about celebrating Australia Day. It was always about remembering the legacy of our First Nations warriors who held the front line. And we know in the First Nations community, it was in 1938 when there were a group of activists who held a peaceful protest outside of Australia Hall in Sydney against the celebration of the bicentenary of Australia, and they marked January 26th as a day of mourning. And so it always has been a day of reflection, a day of mourning, those things that changed for us on that particular day. And interestingly now, you know, for me, having kind of left my community, I did my undergraduate degree in, you know, in Newcastle on the Central Coast. I was fortunate then to live abroad for the final year of my undergraduate degree in Canada, or is what known now as Turtle Island. And it's not until you kind of, I think, you know, I started to kind of leave and experience the world a bit more and then reflect on those experiences. Mm-hmm. And then it really hit me that actually those clash of narratives around that particular day, especially, it really did confront me how many people were celebrating it. So for now, yesterday, which was the January 26th, as you said, I really took a day out to rest and heal. Like, I was emotionally kind of, you know, a bit feeling heavy. And I think it's important for us as First Nations peoples to feel that heaviness and rest with it and allow ourselves to heal. I had a nice sunrise swim with a non-Indigenous friend, and we just went for a walk and we had a look at the rock engravings around the eastern suburbs. I fortunately live, you know, on the beautiful waters of the Bedjigal and Gadigal. And I was showing this friend on one of the most famous trails of this continent, where there were so many Australian flags still kind of walking around. If you look kind of out to the east into the Pacific on one part of the trail, there is an ancient rock engraving of a whale with its fish in its tummy, and there's no marking there of it. There's no sign to commemorate it. And I just thought, this is really telling about how far we have to go in order to reconcile, I think, those clash of narratives. But I absolutely have faith in our generation, Rebe. Like, you know, these conversations, holding space for these conversations, non-Indigenous people being honest about their own discomfort and embracing that discomfort so that we can move through this moment in history. Because a lot of the other stuff I've written about as well, you know, is about reckoning with this history. It's about, I don't believe in reconciliation. I think white people have to reconcile themselves in order for us to address the foundational issues of our nation. Many of us now have traveled to different parts of the world, and there is a sense of at least respect for First Nations peoples in other colonies. Other colonies have engaged in treaty processes. We are still at a point in time where Australians sometimes, while they want to do, you know, good things, they're concerned about that discomfort. But I encourage so many people to embrace it. Unless we sit down, we're not going to be able to move through it.
Absolutely agree. I think in my instance, it took for the Black Lives Matter movement for me to have my own moment of self-reflection and self-awareness and to wake up and realize through social media, through the conversations that were starting to happen, I was witnessing these comments coming through saying, you know, this isn't, when I spoke up about Black Lives Matter and the George Floyd movement, people were informing me this is happening in our own, on our own land. And, you know, that took a moment of, first you feel defensive, you're like, you know, all through your schooling system you're told this narrative that we're this beautiful multicultural colored nation and you aren't told the truth. So the first feeling that comes up is defensiveness and denial. Because it's not what you've been told. And then I agree, you know, you need to encourage that feeling of bringing that self-awareness and then say, like, this is really uncomfortable, because acknowledging that is acknowledging that there have been times where you have been part of this oppressive system and that you have been damaging these stories and part of this conversation and this narrative and the systems that cause oppression. And that is a horrible, horrible shame-inducing feeling to sit with, because, I mean, I think for most people they have good intentions, but that isn't relevant here. The truth is that we have been, we've had racist thought processes and the our actions have been dangerous. And that's a really horrible thing to realize about yourself, but in doing that, in sitting with that and acknowledging that, we can't fix anything that we don't realize is broken. We can't change anything that we don't even admit is the truth. So if you are feeling that discomfort and you're listening to these conversations, invite that in, because that is going to be our catalyst for change. And I want to talk about, in my experience growing up, not only did I have the schooling system telling me a false history, but I had an upbringing with a father and mother who, I'm white passing Asian and I'm mixed race, and my father was white, but he completely denied or kind of tried to hide that we had this Asian background. So again, you know, we had a racist environment where we were trying to deny our own culture to fit in and to not have these judgments passed upon us. So I think in my instance, my community understands that my upbringing was quite adverse and challenging in its own way. But there are so many people that were raised in the 80s and 90s and 2000s with parents who are lovely people and really intend to have nice intentions, or they really are lovely people, but they don't, they haven't woken up. They are still pushing this narrative through their education when they were younger. And so it really is this generation, I feel, that is starting to wake up and starting to learn the truth and starting to come across these stories, thankfully, to social media, I think, plays a huge part in it. But also just having access to these conversations through podcasts and through books and all of that. So yeah, I want to acknowledge my privilege in all of that, because obviously I have been ignorant due to the fact that I am white passing, and that is a privilege in itself.
Yeah, and you've touched on so many important points, I think, and I think for, you know, white people or white passing people, when it comes to sitting with that discomfort, when you do it, you allow space then for other people to engage. Mm-hmm. You know, particularly as black followers being 3% of the population, we can't do this alone. And one, I think, of the topics that has emerged so much, especially post Black Lives Matter, is this notion of truth telling. And yeah, truth telling is important. It absolutely is. But people often forget it's not a feel good process. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not going to feel great, you know, because the truth of our history in this continent, in so-called Australia, is a bloody one. Mm-hmm. It is not pretty. And for First Nations peoples who have had those lived experiences of feeling the full force of colonization and invasion and oppression, you know, our feelings are valid. And that, you know, by people opening up the spaces to have these dialogues and to embrace the difficulty that comes with truth telling is a really powerful moment. And I totally agree in terms of, you know, we're both millennials. We are at that phase, you know, we're that generation that have really ran at this head on through different mediums. You know, prior to social media, information was a bit harder to travel. And I think people often think when it comes to First Nations issues, they've got to do something profound, or they've, you know, it's got to be a huge thing, when in fact, so many simple acts can have huge ripple effects across our society. Like my friend who I was with yesterday, her partner, who had never engaged really in First Nations issues, he had said, and he was white as well, he'd said to her, "Oh, I've just called out my friends online for celebrating Australia Day. I just made a simple comment that this is not a day to celebrate." And I honestly think those things have huge effects on our internal thinking and your own social group. So my point is we shouldn't underestimate how important it is to speak your truth, to hold the front line when it comes to truth telling, and really, I guess, show up on the right side of history is what I like to say. Show up on the right side of justice. And that might have to mean, one, checking your own privilege, two, calling out the racism in your family, and three, fronting up in spaces where you wouldn't normally advocate for First Nations issues, because that's where the shift and the change is going to happen. And this other thing you touched on, which was about, you know, the systems that we have lived in and been forced to live in, and I feel like I've had to navigate a number of systems, being someone who's been born and raised black and then growing up and also trying to carve out a career in the white legal system, I have really begun, you know, I've committed my advocacy to dismantling systemic racism. So to me, I see the world of colonization essentially, it is based on the racist acts of, you know, for example, not many people might know that our laws and our legal systems have racism built into them. So I, you know, in the process of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, for example, I was a working group leader on a particular section of the Australian Constitution. And we have a section in the Constitution called the race power. And the race power enables Parliament to make laws with respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. But those laws, the High Court said, can be for the benefit and the detriment of First Nations peoples. So I think systemically we have a lot of issues to dismantle. As a defence lawyer, I have advocated for a new court system in New South Wales called the Wallama Court, and that's about enabling within our district court jurisdiction elders and respected persons to be engaged in that decision-making process about First Nations peoples that come before the court. And so while I think that, you know, the things you're saying about feeling that guilt and whatever, it has totally been built off the fact that our systems privilege whiteness. And it is our role now, as millennials, as the next generation coming through, we have a responsibility to dismantle those systems. And that's where my work around the Uluru Statement from the Heart, that calls for a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution and a Makarrata process to enable treaties and truth-telling, is to begin a process of dismantling these systems where First Nations peoples can have power in the democratic process.
Yeah, I think I have heard on previous podcasts that you've been a part of the work you're doing with this, the introduction of having elders present when First Nations peoples are at the front of court. So I think that is just amazing, and I really hope to hear that it plays out in the near future for you. I want to ask you a little bit about the statistics on First Nations peoples and incarcerated, because to me, first of all, when I was looking up these statistics, I didn't know where to find honest resources, and that made me question, you know, what I was looking up. As I've read, it says that Indigenous women were 21.2 times more likely to be in prison than non-Indigenous women.
Yeah, so the statistics vary across the continent because each jurisdiction has its own state jurisdictional incarceration laws and rates. So they're quite fragmented. However, it is true that there is a higher rate of First Nations peoples, and in particular women, being incarcerated. So a few years ago, the Social Justice Commissioner, June Oscar, had written a report and done a lot of advocacy around looking at the trajectory of First Nations women being incarcerated, and gathered data from all the jurisdictions. And we know that in that past decade now, there has been a 148% increase in the incarceration of First Nations women alone in the decade. So that's not because, you know, First Nations women are going out and committing heinous crimes. That's because they're caught up in systems that consistently monitor them, over-police them, and then see them as the perpetrator of things. You know, the example that many might know is in Western Australia, if, you know, you don't pay fines, you can get locked up. And there was a campaign with Sisters Inside run by Debbie Kilroy out of Meanjin to pay those fines so women did not have to get locked up. Now, that's not because First Nations women are committing any more of the crimes. It's simply by the fact that they're living in poverty, the examples of what was happening. So, you know, simple things like fines can turn into being incarcerated and locked up is just such a draconian legal system. But, you know, that then has a spiral on effect on the kinship network, on the children in that family. And often you will see in statistics when it comes to incarceration, most people actually, even if you're black or white, this is an example, most people are actually doing sentences in prison of 6 months or less, which means the crime itself actually isn't that serious. It might be a larceny or like a shoplifting or, you know, those kinds of crimes that are crimes out of desperation, really. Most people are not getting locked up for things like murder or manslaughter. You know, there are very few people in our society that have that intent. The legal system absolutely is built on, the criminal process is built on incarcerating the poor. And we really need to begin to unravel that.
Wow. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. It's hard not to relate when you're talking about the story of a woman not paying a parking fine, how many times that would have happened to someone that's white, but also it's very similar to the story of George Floyd and him not paying a bill and the uproar that happened across the world, and yet it's happening here. And we're not aware of it. We don't want to admit it. We're in denial. We're privileged. It's so frustrating, and I can only imagine your frustration for the matter. And that's just one. That is just one example of so many things that need to be right and that are still very much happening in today's world. We just aren't acknowledging it. What I wanted to ask you is, do you have more hope for the future generations, and are you on TikTok?
Look, I definitely have faith that people will show up on the right side of history. Because if I didn't have that, then I wouldn't believe in the advocacy that I'm doing, because the advocacy right. that I'm doing relies absolutely on the power of the people. And if we look at huge moments in our history, even as, you know, far back, even as the 70s, it was people who took to the streets standing in solidarity with First Nations people for change that change actually happened. And that is why something like the Uluru Statement from the Heart hasn't been handed to politicians. It's gone straight to the people, for people to mobilize conversations around systemic changes. And the first step to that is a referendum process to hear First Nations voices. So I believe that we have to be the generation to create change, because our leaders absolutely lack leadership. Do not live in a system where we can rely on our leaders. And at the end of the day, they are accountable to us. And so I think everyone listening has to believe in their own individual power to be able to collectively bring people into the conversation. And remember that we have the capacity to ensure that we are the last generation living with this, you know, perpetual cycle of having these conversations every year about what have we done wrong or right when it comes to First Nations issues. So, I do believe that. And then secondly, no, I'm not on TikTok. Are you?
Yes, I am. And I raise that not because it's completely irrelevant. I promise it has a point. But because there are incredible Black creators on there, and yeah. they are so young, Tila, like they're 16, 18, 20, and the way that they are communicating their stories is a display of resilience and so much empowerment, and they're articulating these painful, traumatic issues that young people have access to. And I find that incredible, because had I been that young kid on TikTok or social media when I was 15 or 16 and actually got to communicate and come across a First Nations person or Indigenous person and hear their stories, I mean, that's got to see some really big change for our future, I believe, because we just didn't have access to that when we were younger.
Yeah, and it's so interesting that you frame that as this notion of these young people having really important stories to share. Mm. Like, we as First Nations peoples come from the oldest surviving peoples on the planet. And that means we are the original storytellers. And so I'm actually not surprised that there are so many young creatives out there speaking truth to power. And I think whatever medium that is going to come through, particularly where in the world we live now, there is a lack of people faith in institutions and systems. And so it is even more important for a young mob, especially, to create their own spaces where they're telling their stories that are not edited, where they're telling their stories that are their lived experiences. And so, I don't know, maybe I'll have to go on now.
I'll share some of the creators that I follow on there. There's several that I follow that are just, they're educating me. And I'm like, this is incredible. This is, yeah, it just feels so good to be a part of and good to learn. And like I said before, just something that didn't exist even 5 years ago. You know, it was Instagram, but you had to kind of follow that person, whereas the TikTok algorithm are people that, yeah, you might have interest in, but you're coming up with these random creators and you think, and they just start speaking and it's just so captivating and so educational and so powerful.
And that's the beauty of it all, right? The beauty is that even in these moments, there are really amazing stories to share. Like, I was out with my friends the other night having dinner. And, you know, they were just like, let's make a TikTok. And I was like, oh, God, don't put me on TikTok. But it's like my friends who they all work at NITV for this particular thing, when they had a collaboration with NITV and TikTok, and that was aired on the night of Invasion Day. And everyone was so into it, and I was just like, oh, you know, I feel like, yeah, I'm having a bit of a FOMO moment now. I guess the last thing I would say is my kind of contribution to that space is sharing stories on Black Colour Book Club. I think of the same thing. I think it's such a powerful thing for, particularly when it comes to, firstly, First Nations embracing our notion of storytelling, because it's not always in books, but allowing this space and this community where non-Indigenous peoples who are ready to engage in that truth-telling process, you know, being able to find a story and go off on that journey in their own time. And so, yeah, I'm the creative, one of the creators behind Black Colour Book Club.
Yes, that was actually it's a great segue to my next question, actually, or a bit of a story I wanted to share with you. So I followed Black Colour Book Club a couple of years ago, and when I first discovered you, and we bought the book that you guys recommended, Finding Our Heart by Thomas Mayer, for my daughter Lexi. And I was having a discussion with her, this was probably about a month ago, and I wanted to, she's five, and she asks the most beautiful, pure, curious questions. And after she heard the story, she asked these questions, she had a very valid reaction and was asking me really challenging questions as well about what had happened and going into depth and, you know, what. And her first question was, what are we doing about it? Which is really cool. And she's like, are we helping? And I said, yes, we are helping, Lexi. And you know, at least you know the truth now, you know. And so that was really powerful. But I did, she kind of like summarized it in a way, because it was a lot for her to comprehend, I suppose. And I've read it to her a number of times, but it was like she now has more capacity to process this information and realize like how big it was. And so I'm going to play for you her summary of it, because it's just really sweet. Okay.
All I want to say is, we need to help the Aboriginals if we see someone treating them bad, badly, so then we get our friends, or if we don't have friends, we just stand up for them ourselves. Mm-hmm. So then if they tell a lie, then we try.
If people are mean to them and tell lies about them,
yeah,
about the First Nation,
then we say we just stand up for the First Nation, not
people.
Yeah, the First Nation people.
Not the people that took their land.
Yeah. We just take them away from, like, the naughty people, and then we'll, that's it.
Look after them.
Yeah.
So it was just so sweet that she has it in her heart to stand in solidarity already, you know. She's like, well, we will protect them and we'll stand next to them and we won't let the mean people talk about them or tell lies about them.
You must be so proud, because I think that is the hope right there. That is the generation that will be living and breathing the hard work we're doing now and these uncomfortable conversations, when this is now just second nature to them. Like, mm-hmm. last year I took my niece and nephew to the Black Lives Matter protest, and it was, you know, such a profound conversation they were having between themselves as well. And this is Lexi's generation, mm-hmm. Where we were driving into the city and there's a Captain Cook statue on one of the pubs in Sydney, and my nephew says to his sister in the back seat, we need to pull that down. And I was like, we had not even had a conversation about the statue conversation at that point. And then he goes, oi, sissy, what are we marching for today? And she's like, looks at him like, we're marching for our land back. And so I just think this generation absolutely fill my heart, and the solidarity that Lexi talks about, standing on the right side of justice, not letting people get away with lies, and and, you know, stepping up into these spaces. I just think that's the most beautiful, profound thing.
Yeah. I'm very proud, and I do hold hope with you, you know, having those conversations with little people. And, you know, I've even seen a shift in my socials, being someone that's vocal about it on my socials. I think the discomfort is becoming more normal, as opposed to it being as shocking as it was for some people. People are waking up. I wanted to say thank you so much for being here. I'm going to be ending the podcast once we've finished talking, Teela, on some of the ways that people can become allies, and I'm sharing some links within my show notes. But I wanted to ask you, if there was one thing, one call to action you could give the listeners today, what would it be?
My call to action right now, in this moment, knowing we are going into an election year this year, we must remember the crap this government have dragged us through, through the pandemic, through history. My call to action is for everyone to write to their local MP saying that they will vote yes to a First Nations voice at a referendum. We must achieve those systemic changes that have been called for, not just within the Uluru Statement from the Heart, but many petitions in the past. Educate yourself about those previous petitions as well. There has been the Uluru Statement, the Yirrkala petition, the Bark petitions, the Barunga Statement, the Larrakia petition. These are the things that Western education is not teaching you. The idea that First Nations voices must be heard is not a new concept, but the one thing that we can do right now at this point in history is writing to your MPs, holding them to account on a referendum, saying you will vote yes, and elevating Black voices in your family, on your social medias. And that's what you live and breathe. So thanks so much for holding space for this.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for being so resilient and strong. And, I appreciate you so much. I can, I just wish I could, do more, and I will continue standing alongside you and using my voice to be an ally. And, thank you so much for your time today.
Yalu, and all the best to Lexi and the next generation who are coming through, because they will show us to stand up on the right side of history.
Thank you guys so much for listening to this week's episode of Empowered. This is probably one of my favorite episodes so far, and I hope that you are able to become more educated and just take in the amazingness and the strength of Tila. I wanted to share two Instagram accounts, but please, search for yourself some Indigenous accounts to follow, some First Nations peoples accounts to follow. One of them is at Common Ground First Nations, and the other one is at Uluru Statement. Those are two accounts that are great to follow. I'll link them in the show notes below, as well as Taylor's account and the Blackfella Book Club as well. But I want to also include Stars Foundation, and that's a place that you can donate funds to support Indigenous girls and young women to attend school, complete year 12, and move into full-time work or further study. I'll include that link in the show notes below. And I thank you so much for listening to this tough conversation and for holding space for it. I also wanted to let you guys know that the journal is available for pre-order that I discussed last week. So if you are interested in purchasing the journal, it becomes available tonight. So you can check out Revy Jane's shop on Instagram if you are interested in making that purchase and introducing journaling to your ritual. Thanks again for listening, guys, and I hope you have a lovely week. Love you. Bye.